Hello, and welcome to Content Talks, a new 5x5 podcast that explores the fascinating, ever-evolving world of content strategy. Every week, we'll be featuring conversations between me, Christina Halverson, and some of the fantastic folks who have very interesting things to say about things that will most certainly interest you. Today, I am delighted to have Ms. Relly Annett Baker. Relly lives in the south of the UK with her husband and super nice studio business partner, Paul Annett, and their two small sons. She is a content strategist and a writer. She runs dedicated workshops in-house with companies big and small. She is also continuing to procrastinate over the draft of her book, Content Creation for the Web, which will be published by Five Simple Steps. It's due out sometime this year. Hopefully before Confab, the Content Strategy Conference, happens here in Minneapolis, May 9th through 11th. Relly, how's the book coming?
Like a deadline, is that?
You know, I was just thinking this yesterday, though. I just finished an article that has been breathing down my neck for the last 3 weeks. And as I finally submitted it yesterday, and as I was lying in bed going to sleep, I thought, God, I hate deadlines, but boy, they feel good after they're gone.
Exactly. Once you finish them, then that's fine. Everything at the moment is like pre-book, after-book life. It's got this kind of looming deadline. It all started well. You know, I kind of started the draft a good few months back and chatting with my editor, and I was very casual about it. And I actually found that while I was okay picking it up and putting it down, I actually, the opposite of what I thought I wanted happened, which is that I really wanted to dedicate a big chunk of time to it. I didn't want it to be this casual project. I wanted to do that whole sit down and write a book thing, which I'd never really kind of set out to do with it. So
yeah, I was going to say that's kind of backwards. Usually authors are like, I want to write a book, and then they sit down and they dedicate these chunks of time to it and realize they actually have no desire to write a book, if that's what it means.
For me, it was incredibly casual. Like Five Simple Steps, he published some really fabulous books from, especially from new authors related to kind of web design and web development. They kind of approached me sometime, probably about this time last year, and said, "Hey, so do you fancy doing a book?" And I was kind of like, "Well, yeah, I could do a book. You know, I'll do a book." And they'd be like, "There's no pressure about deadlines or time. You know, we'll set you up for, you know, thinking about early 2011. But, you know, whatever happens with it." And I was like, "Okay, all right, that sounds good." You know, and I kind of ticked along and I wrote a bit, and my editor sent it back. And after having done a bit, I just thought, no, actually, if I'm ever going to get this done and finished and like it, I actually have to now sit down and dedicate some time to it. So I've got about the next 8 weeks blocked off to have it all signed off, finished, done, and ready to go, which is kind of, it's kind of scary looking down the barrel of this, you know, this book I must write, however many thousand words I must produce. But kind of exciting as well, because I've done a lot of client work recently. So I've done a lot of writing and content strategy for other people. Mm-hmm. It's nice to do something for myself, isn't it? And then the really nice thing about Five Simple Steps and their imprint is that they really want authors to have their own individual voice. They don't want there to be a publisher voice to it, so I get to get away with saying things like your website is a container for liquid shit and stuff like that. So it's been a lot of fun, and sorry, my editor sends me back a draft. He says, we'll just keep it in for now and we'll look at it again later.
Oh, really? You crazy Brit.
Well, do you know what, I don't even know if it's a crazy Brit thing. I think it's a mummy thing. I've become so immune from, you know, the horrendous, disgusting things that small humans can do that it doesn't really seem all that big a deal to me to talk about those birds anymore. So maybe that's where it comes from. But then at least it will be mine.
Yeah, exactly. It will be your little darling.
Yes, quite.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about the book itself. There are, you know, there's really only one other book out there at this point that people point to, which of course is Ginny Reddish's Letting Go of the Words. Tell me about your book, what sparked you to write it and what you're hoping to deliver to folks who will be reading it.
Okay, so I guess the thing about me as a writer is I started off in radio and I moved into advertising and so on, but I ended up really focusing on the web from really early on. And it's basically what I've done for about the last 10 years now, kind of without even thinking about it too hard. So a lot of my experience was about writing for the web. But because of that, I was working a lot of the time with designers and developers who were being left to pick up the pieces that their clients left behind. And I, you know, I'd see them get really frustrated. I had this firsthand working with my husband a good few years ago now, when he first kind of went into web design. And, you know, things clients would expect him to do for about 450 quid was, you know, quite horrifying, really. Right, so I ended up kind of doing a lot of writing, a lot of the business emails and a lot of the communication stuff. And so from that, I ended up writing the content for sites. And I realized what a struggle it was to be able to put yourself in the place of the person that was going to be using the site. It's easy to put yourself in the place of, you know, the developer and say, well, so there's an error message and I need it to say this so other developers understand what the problem is. But if those error messages then become part of a live site, if a user can actually generate those and see them, then that's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. And so from that, that's where my experience kind of grew. So when I came to do a book and Five Simple Steps approached me, it was from the point of view of, well, can we do something that's about writing for the web, for the people that work on the web all the time, for the people who end up kind of having to do these bits and pieces of you know, copy? Because, you know, as you know, it'd be great if there were writers out there everywhere for every project and it got the value it needed. But right. until that happens, until everyone can see how important it is, and we're slowly getting there, there kind of needs to be this interim period where designers and developers can feel more confident about picking up those skills and also the importance of demonstrating them to their clients. If they can show what makes better content, then it's much easier for them to sell the services of a professional able to tackle that stuff as well.
Well, so tell me about some of the tools then that you are sharing in the book to help empower designers and developers to do this, because I will say that I speak regularly at an event apart and the majority of the audience there is made up of designers and developers. And I typically have to pitch throughout my presentation. Yeah, I know I'm talking about content strategy, but designers, developers, you can make a difference in the content and trying to give them tools and empower them to see that. Talk to me about some of the things you're going to be sharing with them or that you are sharing with them that you feel like will empower them to make that difference.
So, The whole point of the Five Simple Steps books is that they're very practical. They're a cross between textbooks and workbooks. So there's a whole section, the fifth section of the book is very much, here's all the things we've talked about and here's how you're going to put them in place related to your own site. So the end of the book should mean you should feel powerful enough to be able to go, right, I can do this on my own personal site. And if I can do it on that, I can do it with other people's. Mm-hmm. So some of that is looking at style guides. How do you put a basic style guide together? How do you define tone of voice? How do we say something is like this but not like this? And then how do we break that down? So there's a lot of looking at aspects of language in error messages. So looking at what's friendly and what isn't. Because a lot of the time we can recognize it inherently, but we can't put our finger on exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a technical, not too technical, but a technical breakdown of what's positive language and what's negative language. I help people look at audits and how to go about doing those and how to break them down into manageable chunks. And I think some of the other stuff that kind of cover is how to have conversations with clients about content tactfully as well.
Right.
Which, you know, that bit is still a work in progress. I haven't got all the answers for that yet, but it's something that I'm actively going and talking to designers and developers and saying, look, you know, tell me about the stories you've had with content. Tell me about the stuff where, you know, it's all gone badly wrong at the last minute. And what would you have done differently next time? Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to have a kind of real section that really talks to designers and developers by designers and developers. I'm just going to be the conduit of saying, you know, if I was in this situation, I definitely would have talk to the client up front about the fact they needed to get a copywriter, or I would have presented them with the forms ahead of time and had them check through them, or that kind of stuff.
Wow, that's an incredibly good idea, because that is a group of people who are always ready to sit down with a martini and tell you about their horror stories with clients, especially I think around that content gap. I bet you've heard some good ones.
Yeah, there've been some crackers. I mean, the thing is that I always believe that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And I regularly run into projects where I have stuff where I think, oh, if only I'd done that before.
Right.
And so I think the more we can say, we share with each other, not just the horror stories, but that I wish we had done this, the more we can learn from what's happened. And I think that those growing pains to a certain extent are throughout the industry as well. Every time a new technology comes in or a new, you know, programming language or whatever, and new things get applied, every time there's, the more you can share that stuff with other people, the more you learn from their mistakes and they can learn from yours.
You know, it's interesting. I just finished a content marketing workshop in partnership with Ann Handley down at a marketing conference in Austin, Texas. And more in my workshops, I'm starting to integrate simply like interviews and conversations between the workshop attendees for exactly that reason. Because it seems to me that rather than sitting and listening to me and then even just sort of doing these, you know, writing exercises or audits on their own, that they are learning so much from sort of the successes and the mistakes that have been made by these other folks who are in the workshop. Now, you said you teach workshops a lot. Is it largely around writing? Do you talk to them about these client communication tactics? Tell me what companies are asking you to come in and do.
So, it really varies. I get a lot of higher education places because they're very keen on workshops. I think it's mainly because they've got a lot of space and a lot of tables with nice chairs. So
what would fix this massive problem? It's a workshop. an eight-hour workshop. Let's really go for it.
Workshop. There is an element of that. But then it's also quite powerful. I find the companies that use workshops well are the companies that know that departments don't necessarily talk to each other. And by having a workshop and an independent facilitator means they have a chance to get their grievances out. I do spend a lot of my time being a content relationship counselor as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about that being a content therapist.
Yes, yep, very much. Yep. That whole thing about, you know, well, my thing should be on the homepage because, well, mine should be on the homepage because, well, how about we, you know, we have an independent test and see which one performs best, and you know, that kind of stuff goes on. So I do a lot of with higher education, local government, but also I'm making a move towards doing stuff directly with designers and developers and agencies and talking to them about how they can talk to their clients about content, you know, the big fat elephant in the room, and introducing really simple things like page tables. So how do we get content from, stop it being this big amorphous blob, and how do we divide it up and present it as something that's doable? And if the client still refuses to believe it's doable, printing out in a big binder, handing it over and saying, this is what you need to fill in before your workshop, your website is ready to go. Mm-hmm. How long do you want to, you know, procrastinate over it? It's right. Still going to need doing. So, I mean, there's a bit of carrot and a bit of stick to it, depending on which clients. And so, again, I do workshops. I did one of 5 Simple Steps in London just the other week. And, you know, we had a mix of, you know, big publishing houses, people from there, some higher education people again, some small agencies, some freelancers who all face this problem. How on earth do I get the content in time to put it on the site? And then, so the first half of the workshop was kind of talking about, well, how do we get clients to accept that content isn't something that's magicked up, and how do we break that down? And then what can we do with it after we've got the content? You know, how can we design for it? How can we test it to make it more inspirational and also to push designers for them to have a reason to ask for it? If they can do something really exciting with the content because they've got it, you know, ahead of the 11th hour, then they're more likely to push and ask for it so that they can do something interesting because there's an inherent benefit to them.
Mm-hmm. So how are you sort of working to demonstrate very clearly what those benefits are to them? Is it largely through just asking them to remember the disasters? Do you have specific examples and success stories that you're able to talk about with them?
I talk a lot about designed content and show some examples of that. So things like Greg Wood from Erskine Design over here in the UK is very well known for doing excellent designed content, you know, with his own blog posts. And
what is his URL?
I think it's gregwood.co.uk.
Okay.
You can definitely find him through Erskine Design.
Okay.
And he does great stuff. And he did a presentation very recently in a conference I saw, which showed that, you know, simple things like a recipe. If you put a recipe online with just a picture at the top, and then the ingredients, and then the instructions, it wasn't anywhere near as successful as showing step by step photos and illustrations and stressing, you know, what temperature the oven had to be on at what point. And you can only do that if you get the content ahead of time and spend some time, you know, labouring love on it. And so by demonstrating that, you know, not everything in the world is going to be have that much attention lavished on it because there are only 24 hours in the day and I don't want to spend all 24 of them designing content. But that by picking, you know, making some topics a priority, it gives you some latitude to do some interesting things with that content. And certainly that's something that my husband and I at Super Nice Studio have been talking about, you know, what we want to do in the future and how we can explore different areas of design content and also how to bring audio forms and video forms of content into that as well. How do we start integrating this so that it's not here's a page and then here's a video player at the bottom or at the top, or, you know, how can we work that into the whole experience?
Right. Now that kind of brings up an interesting point that I think designers are constantly coming up against and as a result, banging their heads up against a brick wall. What do you do when clients say to you, yeah, text, whatever, I think that this story would better be told in video, or I need to have, you know, that flash demonstration of my product? What, as a content person who's trying to work with these designers, how do you sort of come back at the client, or how do you begin to work with the designer to say, are there other ways that this might be better communicated? And if so, how can you begin to talk to the client about that?
Well, also going into the book is the magic flowchart, which is it's basically something I knocked up. I think I did it on Paper Festival, but I've got a version in Omnigraffle for sure that I show, which is trying to work out, you know, that thing between resource and time and commitment. So is your story better told in video? Yes, no. Why? Well, let's have a look at the details for that. Is it going to be something that's going to have a permanent place on the site? Yes. Well, then it might be worth looking at whether video is communicating that message better. Is it something with a lot of information packed into it that you're going to have to cover extra ground on? So, you know, a presentation might not be best by video, but maybe better by a set of slides and annotation. So what do they mean exactly by video? And, you know, are we looking at it just for the glossy factor? And in which case, what do you hope to do with this glossy factor? So then it's a case of evaluating whether they're going for viral content and whether that actually matches up. I mean, I've worked with a few accountancy firms and things like that who want to do glossy video introductions of their staff as if anyone cares. And it's very hard right. to then get across to them that your staff are great and everything. And I really think, you know, a nice staff page and with some nicely shot pictures of them that aren't on that cat puke background that they all seem to find for everyone to stand in front of. And what is it with that? I don't really know. Some hideous velvet that just gets sold in photography studios everywhere, I assume. And yeah, let's have some personal items about them. So tell me what their favorite film is and tell me when, you know, where they went to university or whatever. Don't flood me with that information. But them sitting on camera and telling me that doesn't make it, I'm not going to watch that. I'm not going to watch it. If it's a story with a narrative that goes beginning to end and you can tell that story in the length of time of 2 to 3 minutes and you want, really good visuals that go with it, well, then there's capacity for video and we need to then look at what the budget for that is, because that tends to be the stopping point with video. And the expectation at the moment is that because everyone's got a video camera or everyone's got a phone or whatever, that we can produce something that we want to put up on a site. And that's fine if you're trying to do some sort of Jackass style stunt, less if you're an accountancy firm. People don't really want you wheeling around on your office chairs.
Well, but let me say this though, because a huge thing within the social media movement is people are like, exactly that. You've got a flip cam. Your phone has a camera in it. Anybody can throw together a podcast. Do it. Create that content. Get that out there, because that's what's going to bring people back to your site and engage them and create loyalty. I don't know if content marketing has taken hold over there, but it's just huge over here. Well,
I get that argument. I hear it and I laugh because, frankly, I don't know about you. In these podcasts, have you found cutting out the time to do the podcast to be a bit of a chunk of your schedule?
Not yet, but I am just starting. And, you know, it's easy because all I need to do is call really smart people and let you talk for however long you want to talk. And then I just send it to Dan.
Right. So that's not so
bad. I mean,
bad.
I very carefully plan out each one.
The thing is that everything needs a bit of planning. I get clients and say, oh, you know, we could do a video podcast, you know, each week. And I say, well, you could, but really to do a half an hour video podcast that isn't, you know, that isn't just your face in front of a video camera, which gets very boring very quickly. You have to plan out what content's going to be on that, so that might take some time. Then you have to add in some sound at the beginning and some sound at the end and put that out. And unless it's a proper part of your business model, it then starts becoming cumbersome, which is why we end up with so many podcasts and video podcasts and other things where there's been two, maybe three episodes, and then it goes silent.
Which is the problem with all social media initiatives, I think. With companies, you know, they're being told, hey, it's social media, just dive in. You have to just try a bunch of different things and see what works. But exactly, they start these things as campaigns and not necessarily as commitments. And then there's just, you know, littered, abandoned blogs and podcasts and stuff, just, you know, on the wayside everywhere you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that then starts to dilute the message that they had in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a tough one because it's one of those things where you go and talk to one client and video is perfect for them, but they don't have the money to do it, and you're thinking, oh, if only. And then you go to another client who's got a lavish amount of budget, but just no content worth filming, and yet still wants to.
Yeah, well, and you see that all over the place too. So let's back up for just a second then and talk about, because we're kind of talking around the subject, but let's talk about content strategy specifically, because we're doing this, you're doing such an amazing job about talking about, how, you know, what specific kinds of tools and decision-making processes that can be shared and taken on by designers and developers. Talk about sort of your involvement with sort of this rise of the content strategy community in the UK. Where do you think that's coming from? How do people in the UK perceive content strategy as a discipline? Just talk a little bit about what you're seeing there.
Yeah, it's an odd one. I mean, it's kind of, there's a slightly British thing to the way that we've taken it on board, which is slightly grumpily, because that's, you know, characteristic generally, but not grumpy in a, we don't want this kind of way generally, just in a grumpy, it's just another thing to think about kind
right.
of way,
mm-hmm.
As in, oh, I now I have to get a content strategist. Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, send right. someone from HR. We have a long history of, you know, obviously the press and other things here. So we have some kind of reference to content organization, which I think a lot of agencies are taking on board. Certainly the ones I've spoken at. I mean, that I've just literally left the agency I was at, Headscape, to go on and form Super Nice with my husband. But you know, they were quite forward thinking, you know, 18 months ago, to be looking for a content strategist.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty much the only agency outside of London that I could think of that was doing it. I couldn't think of that many in London. But now 18 months down the road, it's possibly not as unusual. I think it's starting to happen. I think there's an awful lot of web editor jobs that are being dressed up as content strategy. But, you know, that's just my uneducated reckon. I couldn't say for definite.
Can you talk for just a minute about what you think the difference is between those two jobs?
Yeah, well, I think a web editor spends a lot more time writing and rewriting content than a content strategist does. A content strategist certainly does some writing and certainly some example content where required. But a content strategist has a much more top-level view of what's going on, whereas a web editor is going to be commissioning things for certain pages, having, you know, worked with the content strategist to work out what page tables are required and so on. And they're often the ones there in the trenches, whereas a content strategist, not so much, has been, at least that's been my experience,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I also like to do writing. I am a content strategist and a content writer because I like to mix it up. I see that the separation of the roles is big enough that I like to be able to say I do both as in separate capacities. They're not one and the same thing.
I think that that's part of what is really sparking the interest of people whose titles currently are web editor, web writer, even content manager, that they're seeing, you know, these tasks that I'm doing, I can make a difference further upstream by asking the right questions and helping make these different decisions that will prevent kind of all of the last minute 11th hour emergencies that I think do take up so many hours of web editors and web writers' time.
That's it. I think a lot of the time here where there's a lot of editorial history, and that's from publishing and from print, and that's been taken into the web, especially within larger agencies who recognize the need for, you know, a print platform, a web platform, marketing platform, and so on. And I do think that a lot of these web editors, like you say, have just had, you know, the shitty 11th hour moment where they get a phone call at, you know, 10 to 5 on a Friday saying, oh God, we're launching this thing on Monday, no one's filled it. And they're there thinking, well, why wasn't anyone thinking about it? So then they start asking the questions. And so I think it's, you know, I think web editors are the perfect people to think about moving into content strategy. And there's no reason why they can't do both, providing you are aware that they are different roles that blend well.
Right. So we only have a minute or two left, but I do want to ask, if I'm a web editor and this content strategy thing has caught my interest and I'm thinking, yeah, I would like to have more of a higher level view of what's going on here, what, you know, what are some pieces of advice that you would give that person?
Come to Confab. Come to find out all about it. My check's in the post, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I would say start off by Googling content strategy. Okay. There's definitely stuff out there. Have a poke around, see what you like. Find out if there's a content strategy meetup near you, especially where I am. There's not that many and they're very new and people come along tentatively as if they don't deserve the badge. And pretty much people, that we almost need to drop the strategy from it. It's like a content meetup because so many people are writers and developers interested in learning more about content and that kind of stuff. So come along to one of those or, you know, have a look around online. There's a Google group. There are some excellent books out there, including this one, Content Strategy for the Web by, just can't quite.
Oh my God. You know what? That book is so outdated.
Well, it's still a good start, I think. And obviously, come the summer, there will be a content creation for the web.
Well, and we also have Erin Kassane's book, The Elements of Content Strategy, that's being published by A Book Apart, coming out on March 8th. I know. We're all lined up waiting for our copies of that. Yeah. Actually, do you know what? They are giving a copy of that book to every single person that attends Confab.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know. We've mentioned Confab a few times. Let me just give the URL to our listeners. It's Confab, Confab, 2011.com. You can go and check it out. I think that actually the Brain Traffic Content Strategy Workshop just sold out.
Woo!
I know.
That's exciting.
It is exciting.
That is good.
Go out there and mold the souls of content strategists everywhere. Continue world domination by content strategy. It'll be great.
Yes.
Hey, Relly, thank you so much for sitting in. This has been terrific. I feel like we could talk for another hour and a half. So I certainly would love to have you back on the show sometime soon. We are looking forward to seeing you in May. You're going to make the trek over and you'll be speaking to our audiences at Confab.
I will.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be great. It's going to be a lot. We keep calling it sort of like the content strategy meetup of the millennium.
Yes.
Although then we're going to do it again next year. I don't know what we'll call it then. All right, Relly, thank you so much for your time. And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Content Talks. Thanks to Dan Benjamin and 5x5 TV for giving us the opportunity to come online. That's it for this week, and I'll see you next week. I'm Christina Halverson, and good luck with your own personal world domination with content strategy.